it just pays way better. You're wanting to become a better developer. I wouldn't recommend freelancing, honestly.
Welcome back to another episode of Backend Banter. Today, I'm joined by Louis, is it Louis Menelaus? Am I pronouncing that right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yep.
Okay, cool.
Many laws. There's many laws in this country. That's why I like to say, kind of like how that's how it goes right there.
Is that Canada? Are you Canuck?
No. So I am Canadian, like Canadian citizen. I was born in Scotland and then I moved here to Canada when I was, 5 years old. So you don't hear the accent. I am basically full on Canadian, but like, if you want to get technical with it, it's from Scotland.
Oh, wow. Okay. I didn't even realize that. I'm also terrible with accents, but didn't even know your last name was Menelaus until we connected on Twitter, because your YouTube channel, which is what I knew you for, is Coding with Louis, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, 100%. I used to go by Louis Menelaus for so long, like maybe up to like 50,000 subscribers, but decided to just do the whole Coding with Louis thing. And I always have this thing, it's like, should I switch it back to just my name? But, who knows?
Yeah.
I think most people just affiliate me with Coding with Louis, where I can put first name Coding, middle name with, and then last name Louis. That'd be interesting as well.
Oh no, I've been roasting people on Twitter over the last couple of days for having the last name Codes.
Yeah.
So I guess for you, name Coding. Yeah.
Yeah, I switched it. I knew you were roasting, so I was like, all right, I'll switch it. I'll be Coding with Louis, not Louis Codes,
Yeah, not Louis Codes, exactly. Well, that's okay. You're the only one I know that's doing the reverse. This should be really fun. I think what we're gonna do is go through basically like a chronology of your experience kind of learning to code, starting your own web development agency with some friends. We'll talk all the way through that. And then I really want to wrap the whole thing up talking about creating coding content, get a little meta with it, because you recently put out this video. It's titled, "We Need to Talk About Developer Influencers," that I remember watching a couple weeks ago when it came out, and I thought it was really good.
Thank you.
Spoiler alert. Basically, the idea is there's a lot of developer influencers out there, and myself included, and we don't write as much code as we used to, right? The whole thing is like, we wrote a lot of code and then we started talking about code. And if you want to talk about code full time, just a natural consequence of that is that you don't write as much code, which is weird. So anyways, we're going to talk about that. But let's start just like way back at the beginning. When did you first learn to code and how?
Oh yeah. I mean, I always like to say when I first started doing it is like roughly when I started doing it professionally, because that's when you start doing it more often. And that's kind of like when you're more aware that it is programming, I guess you could say. For me personally, I started programming when I was like 13, I believe. And it was on the game, which I brought, like, is still huge to this day, Roblox. The game Roblox came out in like 2006. So it's not a new game.
I didn't realize how old it is.
Holy oh, it's crap. Old. Yeah. So I was 13 at the time, or 12, 13 ish. And it was still the same premise, right? You can go into games, you can script using Lua and be able to make games that you want. Obviously, it's much better now. But back then, you were still able to have a lot of control with it. So at the time, I wanted to find ways to make my levels better for me and my friends. So I would take existing assets like a door, and you can like program who can go through that door based off of your username. And that's how I do it. So Lua is technically the first programming language that I've ever learned and used. But at the time, I didn't even think it was programming. I just thought it was annoying. So it was just
a really weird way, like with
text.
Yeah,
what's that? Yeah, seriously. Like, why can't I just like drag and drop something, like something at the time? So, and then obviously through high school, I learned after that, ActionScript, which was for Adobe Flash, which I learned in high school. So, it's funny because there's a trend here of like creator-based things and languages that are embedded within systems already, not in the complicated way, but in that way. So I'm always creating something at the end of the day, it seems. So yeah, so the first time professionally, I guess I went to my local school here, which is like community college, and I learned how to code, and they taught the basics of things that you would learn in an enterprise area, similar to what you would do if you went to like computer science, like Java, C, PHP at the time as well, which, PHP 5, I think it was. So it was like technology that I didn't end up using mostly on my day-to-day work. So after that, it was just mostly, like on my own, I learned myself. So it was a long, complicated answer, but I would say 2015 is probably, or 2013, I guess, in school is when I first kind of like got really involved with code.
Java and PHP. I'm really glad my university didn't start me with Java and PHP because I probably would have quit. You just named my two least favorite programming languages of all time.
Oh my goodness. Well, it's funny too, because like at the time it was like, because I know PHP, I mean, not new, but like it went through like a revolution at the time, right? Like they skipped 6 to go to 7, had a lot of really good features in there. And then it went on to 8, which is now. But at the time is PHP 5, which most people have their gripes about. But the textbook we're learning from, I think, was like PHP, like the version before that. So we had a lot of, so like we almost had the missing features that way. It was a mess. Yeah, I agree. PHP, not fun.
When I was in high school, I went to the local community college to take some programming courses. So I was like a sophomore or junior in high school. And I'd go to the local community college, take some programming courses. They were all in Python. And it was at a time when, I mean, this was like 2011. And it was like the shift from Python 2 to 3 was underway. But it was still early enough, or at least, I don't know, maybe my university was behind enough that... like this schism was a real problem of like, cause there's huge differences between Python 2 and 3 syntactically, like even just printing to the console, like there's a different syntax for that.
The brackets. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like putting it in quotes and it being a keyword versus like it having a proper function call. It was an absolute disaster. But the nice thing is once we did get moved to 3, I do enjoy Python. It's not my least favorite programming language.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's funny cause like, as I have like, gone further into my programming career, because I use Python mainly for everything, because for me, what I valued specifically a lot with the clients we were working at the time is like development speed. We needed to get like versions out fast so that they could like validate their product to users. And then at that point they would decide, is this going to work or is this not? And like when you're dealing with that kind of like fast turnaround time, you don't care necessarily about how stable the system is, because you might end up taking the whole thing down tomorrow. But it's funny because as I go into some more projects that I have built like later on in my development career, I kind of like look at Python now, you know, I as much as I love using it, I do kind of not enjoying the dynamic aspects of the language.
The dynamic typing, yeah.
Yeah, it's because like I'm not, like, you know, JavaScript had TypeScript, right? And that kind of like made it much easier for people to run their TypeScript code. Python is kind of like getting to that level, which I think is pretty cool. I actually made a prediction that I think that it's going to have its TypeScript moment. I mean, technically already has, right? With Pydantic V2. I know that's a huge library at the moment, but yeah, no.
We need Tython. Agree.
Tython, yeah. Tython, yeah. That's what we need, Tython. Yeah, T-H-A-I-thon, you know, Tython like that. That sounds, that'd be pretty good. Pun too.
I needed to have you and Michael Green on at the same time. I did an episode with him like 20 episodes back, and it, we got into a little bit of banter about whether or not dynamic typing is a good thing. He's a big Python fan, but it sounds like I am of the same mindset as you, which is like I like Python. I mostly use it for like very small scripts these days, or honestly for teaching. Like I still think that Python's one of the best languages just for learning like computer science basics, programming basics. But like I don't ship production web servers in Python. The dynamic typing is the biggest pain point for me, and it's like, you know, egregiously slow. But
yeah, it's very slow. Yeah, I mean, and that's just the funny thing, right? At the end of the day, like what I've realized is that Python or dynamic languages, period, is like a tool, right? Like you can obviously create extensive types for, you know, like if you're using Rust or whatever, but you know, a lot of the times for the tool that I use, if like, let's say if I was just trying to connect two APIs, right? Like gluing two services together or something like that. Most of the time, Python is the best job for it because you're not going to be maintaining it really too much. You're just going to be putting it up. If it works, it works. There's not really many edge cases, and I can move on to bigger and better things. That's what I like about Python the most now into my career. But then, you know, a lot of other things I regret using it for. So
early, like early on when you were starting this web dev agency with your friends, was that while you were still in school learning Java and PHP and C?
So somewhat. So we started the agency kind of like after I graduated, but at the time I was like taking on like freelance clients, okay, right? Like yeah. I was taking on clients to help. And usually what it would just be at the time was develop a WordPress website for them.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, you kind of get into this crappy thing where it's like, all right, it's plugins. And a lot of the times their budgets just weren't there. So they wouldn't want to buy some sort of plugin, but you also wanted to put a good reputation for yourself as well. So I would have to make these plugins sometimes. And that's with PHP. And this is kind of like when web development starts to become programming a little bit more in the traditional sense, because now you're building functionality. I mean, it's not backend development because I mean, it's WordPress, right? You're kind of like almost dealing with something in the middle, but you're still dealing with databases at that point too, because, you know, it's using MySQL and then you're managing state. Like it's an interesting kind of transition that way. But yeah, that's how we went into it. So WordPress was doing that. And then that's when me and my friends were like, screw it, because they had multi-purpose talents as well. Like they were into photos, they were into videos, and like they had like expensive equipment too. And a lot of the time when you're making these types of websites, that's when the two connect, right? So that's why we decided to start that agency at the time.
Yeah, it's important to remember as a programmer, as a student of computer science, that like there's so many different ways that people with programming skills end up becoming employed, right? Mm-hmm. Like what you're describing to me, like this kind of like web dev agency business, like it kind of skews in my mind a lot towards like local businesses. You're often doing like kind of like a full suite marketing thing for them, right? Like it sounds like maybe your friends were taking photos for clients. Am I kind of going down the right track?
Yeah. When it started off, it essentially was exactly that. It was like, it was for marketing purposes. Yeah.
And so like, there's some programming involved. You've got to know PHP. You've got to know how to do like Google Analytics or whatever other kind of, you know, technical things need to be done to get the marketing done. But like at the end of the day, you're kind of in like the marketing industry. And there's like this whole other industry, which is where I kind of got my start, which is like SaaS, right? And you're building like CRUD applications in Ruby and Rails and Go and JavaScript. And it's important to remember that like those industries are very different. And like, the working styles, the salaries, like everything's just going to be wildly different. So tell me a little bit more about the agency. Like for those full 6 years, it sounds like you kind of made a pivot. I'm guessing, did you kind of pivot away from WordPress?
Absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, we still obviously would take on work if it was needed, but we found like a bit of an automated system for that. And, you know, once you're able to raise your rates at the time with like your portfolio, it's easier to just kind of use that to leverage to get more clients on using websites. Sometimes we wouldn't even use WordPress. A lot of the times we would, like, knowing depending on who the client was, we would build our own solution. I mean, of course, just like anything, there's a right tool for the job. But essentially that, yeah, we decided eventually that if we wanted to start making good money, we would have to like pivot into something that would make sense, I guess you could say. And that was kind of the more software development solutions that we built. So there was a lot of interest, like, I mean, I'll say interesting software because it's not technically interesting. It sounds cool, but like the development aspect was it. But one of the first projects we did to kind of do this transition over was there was this here in Canada, geographically we're really large. And in the middle of it, there's this province or, you know, kind of like a state for if those, you know, watching are not Canadian, called Alberta.
States and Freedom Units. Yeah.
Yes. States and Freedom Units. Yeah. There we have this province called Alberta. And there it's really cold. But what's one of the biggest things there is that there's a lot of oil industry. It's just like huge for oil. And one of the things that they have to do is they have to like always have like some sort of temperature that that is like monitoring all of their systems. This goes above my head.
So you've got like sensors out on like equipment and you're making sure that nothing's like going too high or below like a threshold.
Well, to be clear, we're not doing that part. I mean, that would be a pretty big undertaking to kind of just do something like that, right? You know, like, hey, first project, let's look at your nuclear reactors, right? And just get this small little agency to do it, right? Just completely blow up all of Canada. No, What we did was there was this software that they needed to use that would convert all those units that's in a spreadsheet and then convert it into an XML format as well as validate it. So that's when I would have to learn at that point XML, which this is like, we're talking about 2017, 2018 at this point, right? Like XML is not new. So it's a really old format, right?
It was old then. Yeah.
It was old then. Yeah. Like this is not new. So we had to like validate XML, give like a user interface that told people how to do it, as well as like create these conversion points, which was like, again, like this felt like very old school style programming. This felt like something that you would see back in the days when you were like, creating your like visual basic kind of software. So that's what we started off first. And that's kind of like the pivotal moment, because even though that this interface, I guess you could say, was, I would say fairly simple in design, the functionality was fairly complex. And then you just realize that that difference between like making websites versus like making custom solutions is that there's a huge discrepancy in between them, because they're so saturated. Like again, like you go on Fiverr, there's people offering to make a website and launch you a website for $5. Not like that's going to be any good, but like people, like it just shows how saturated the market is versus something up there. So that's why we made that switch to doing more software-based solutions.
So do you make a distinction in your mind between a website and a web app? Do you think that's useful vernacular?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, the way I see it too, is like a website is something for marketing, or it's for like reading, I guess you could say. So like something I like to say is like documentation, or, you know, like if you want to go to your pizza restaurant or something, right, that like you want to know what's on their menu, you'd go to a website for that, because it's just like display of information. While I find like a web app is more so a web app provides functionality. Of course, there's a lot of like blurred lines here, because if you go to Domino's website, that's basically a web app, right? It's not a website, but at the same time, like there's still marketing material on it. But then also like if you go to any website, like a documentation website, for example, like DocsRS, like they have to like build that like a web app, because it's not just documentation. There's a whole database they have to like screen for, they have to update it regularly. Like, so yeah, like I think the concept of there being like the website and the web app is like almost just kind of merged into one nowadays. But back then it was like pretty obvious.
That's fascinating to hear you say that. So like, traditionally, like last 5 or 6 years. Yeah, back in my day, 5 years ago, right? I used to like make this distinction, especially just like mentally all the time, of like, oh, is this going to be a website or web app? If it's a website, we can just use WordPress or like static site generation, whatever. If it's a web app, we'll like bring in some heavy hitters, right? We might have like a JSON API or whatever. Ryan Florence, the guy who made the Remix framework, recently published, I think it was a blog post that was like, the web app website distinction is like doesn't exist or something. I'm gonna like misquote it, but I will link it in the description below. So if you're curious what the hell I'm talking about, it's gonna be down there. But basically the idea was like this distinction, you know, maybe we're making the wrong distinction. And my belief is kind of, I wonder if all these arguments we get into in web development kind of stem from this root problem of like, everyone's working on different types of applications. Like some people are just kind of like adding custom functionality to WordPress. Some people are building static sites. Some people are building documentation. The site that we're using to record this podcast, Riverside, like this is clearly not just a website, right? It's recording video and doing local storage and some crazy stuff. But like everyone's working on different stuff. And we're all trying to like pick technologies that work for our use case, and I wonder if we're all just like overgeneralizing. like this tech stack's working really great for me and my use case, everyone should use it.
No, absolutely. I mean, like for me, like if I was to really like dig deep down into it, it's like such a boring answer, but like to me, I just like it comes down to money, I think, at the end of the day. Like if someone wants to pay me $1 million to build them this cool website, I will use any framework. I will use the one that was like just released into alpha yesterday, you know what I mean? And then do the craziest animations. But I think at the end of the day, what ends up happening is that everything comes down to budget. And so this is where for most people, I will say, for most developers, this distinction comes in like the scope of the project. So like if like, let's for example, let's say it was a website for your local pizza place. They just want to update their menu once in a while. They just want to update their hours, maybe do like a little blog post here and there. Well, like you're not going to think about like, oh, I could build this cool custom widget using React, right? Because at the end of the day, like you don't have time for that. Their budget doesn't fit accordingly. So you will just kind of fall back into this website paradigm where you're like, okay, WordPress is fine. They can go into the back end, they can update it whenever they want, and then we call it a day, right? But then obviously when you get into web app, like part of me thinks what's funny with like web apps is that when you are getting into the area of like server side generation with like, you know, nowadays it's like there's a whole ton of frameworks, right?
Like I think Next Astro, or Nuxt or Astro. Yeah.
Well, I was thinking more so like Astro or like, was it Jekyll or Hugo? Like one of those ones where it's like, you just
run a static kind of, site. Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Sorry. Static site generators. Yeah. You just run those. And it's like, those are just generating websites at the end of the day too. Where you can add, like we're kind of entering the territory now where even those static site generators are just to make websites are needing some sort of like knowledge of front end development, which you would use to build web apps, you know? So right. We are very much merging into this like kind of centralized area where the distinction, I think, in my opinion, it only just comes down to money. You know, I think every developer would want to build the coolest thing if they have infinite budget, but most of the time they don't. So they just stick to like WordPress and then they go to the website kind of my way of thinking, I guess you could say.
Yeah, no, I think that's accurate, especially as like a project grows. So like you start out with this, you know, you're like, it's just a blog, it's static site. I'm going to do the simple thing, right? I'll use Hugo, I'll generate
famous
a static
last
site.
Words.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And it's like, oh, but like, I'll just like add some JavaScript snippets here to like add some like interactive functionality with the code, right? Like, so maybe your blog is a coding blog and it's like, well, I want people to like be able to run the code on the website. Like, yeah. It's just a little JavaScript and like a library. And then you end up with...
Then you end up uploading onto, you know, GitHub, you made a logo for it, right? It's now an open source. You're now an open source contributor, right? Now you go in the pull request. People are trying to, you know, so yeah, your blog, your little feature somehow become the new JavaScript framework for building sites, you know, and then you get 500,000 stars later. And there you go. You're just, you've made a blog into a full-time career that is powering a ton of things. It's like you almost shoot yourself in the foot by accident, you know?
Yeah, and I get worried because like, you know, I'll use a bunch of different tools for different jobs. So like, for example, on Boot Dev, our tech stack is at the moment fairly simple. We've got Hugo for our blog. It's a static site. It truly is static. There's like really no JavaScript running. Except for maybe a couple snippets here and there. All right, I've broken the rule a little bit. But then we have like our web app, which was a Vue 3 single page application. We recently kind of were forced to move to, we decided on Nuxt because we needed like server-side rendering for SEO purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like really frustrating to me because I felt like I was adding like all this complexity, a whole new server just to serve, you know, it's essentially a back-end for front-end situation. And now we're getting into this weird territory where we're trying to decide like what belongs on our JSON API in Go, what is the responsibility of the Nuxt server. Nuxt has like a crazy amount of features, in my opinion, that I don't care about. Things like it can render static content. I'm like, I don't care. Like I put that on my blog. So I don't know. Like the feature, the web development space, I feel like we're hitting. Just over the last couple of years, we've really hit a new inflection point of confusion where 4 years ago, I feel like the argument was really just like, should I make an SPA or should I use WordPress? And now I feel like we've just blown that up to like, now there's 10 different technologies to choose from and philosophies behind them.
Yeah, I find that, yeah, I mean, it's funny because like even when I got into the JavaScript ecosystem, like early on, right? jQuery was kind of like on its last years. So I would use jQuery. I somewhat enjoyed it. I wasn't crazy about it, but I enjoyed it because it just made things simple. You know, I could remove a class easily. I can do callback functions, right? Like it was cool for what I did at the time. But yeah, you're right. Like there's so, even at the time, there was so much complexity being added into the whole JavaScript framework. And I find that now, especially like this whole concept of like server-side rendering is like, they say that that's the future of JavaScript is on the server and not in the case of like Node.js or Dino or Bun, which are all, you know, that's a whole separate story on itself, but more so like, yeah, like the Next.js, you know, Vercel comes out with it. It's massive, but then there's no open source version of it. There's no open source, like maintained, like Well, I don't like, even know if I can say that either. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like it's open. I was listening to Dax talk about this recently. Mm-hmm. It's like it's open source, but a ton of the features kind of only work out of the box easily on Vercel. So it's like, you know, there's a lot of criticism about like it's open, but like how open is it really? Because it's like really hard to deploy it anywhere else.
I think that actually might be the best analysis of it, right? Like, I mean, with Vercel, like in Next.js, it is open source, right? But like, it's almost like the design is meant to vendor lock you, which kind of like goes against the philosophy of open source, even though it is open source. I was going to say React obviously is made by Meta, which is a way bigger company and like, you know, not open source whatsoever. But at the same time, I do think that the React server components is somewhat like trying to find a way that it can be like deploy anywhere, like just figure it out on your own and you're good to go versus the whole click to deploy to Vercel, you know, to make this much better. But yeah, so even with that kind of things right now, there is so much more complexity. But, you know, I think also too, developers just shoot themselves in the foot at the end of the day. You know, yeah. we just have this natural inclination to be like, oh, I gotta like be a better developer, or I gotta get with the times. I don't want to make something that looks crap and all this thing. Like, I think we get inspired really easily and we think it's like, all right, we just gotta make better text stack decisions and then just kind of like add more to our plate, I guess you could say.
My perception is like there's a ton of opinions. There's like more opinions now in web development than there's ever been. There's more options, but also it's kind of easier than it's ever been. Like, you know, as long as you pick a reasonable technology, like you're going to be able to ship that project, right?
Yeah.
And the business, like failing or not, is almost never the tech stack, especially in the early days, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it was funny because the other day I was just kind of, you know, I started building this project out and I was just thinking like, you know, I'll give an updated version of JavaScript, like rather than just going with just the React kind of framework, I was just like, all right, I'll just kind of go right into it and see what's up. And so I used Theo's T3 stack, I believe it's called. So it used a couple things like, you know, obviously TypeScript, Drizzle, ORM, all these like cool features. And you're right, like you just build stuff so fast. And that is just kind of the beauty behind the whole JavaScript ecosystem is that once you do get started, you go really fast. So it is really awesome.
The only downside is you have to write JavaScript. Yeah.
Yeah. What's your opinion on TypeScript? Do you like TypeScript or do you like the type but not the script?
Yeah, basically. That's basically it. I definitely choose TypeScript over JavaScript pretty much every time when I have to make that choice. Like I said, our front end at Boot Dev is written in like Nuxt and Vue 3. Our back end is written in Go. It's a JSON API. But that like back end for front end is all TypeScript. And when we moved from JavaScript to TypeScript, my life got a lot easier. Mm-hmm. So yeah, huge fan of static types, you know, being able to take an interface on the front end and map it to a Go struct on the back end and trust that all the fields exist as that like JSON data is moved back and forth from the front end. Pretty powerful.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, and it was actually funny that you say that because I think I remember seeing an article that you wrote here about, not in a bad way, like in a good way, like as in a props. It's like learn the technology before the framework, right? And I thought that was interesting because I think that's a huge part of even like my learning journey is that a lot of the times people kind of just forget, like, or especially if you're like kind of new, you kind of forget what frameworks are for versus kind of like being the standard, like almost like the bottom level, you know, because for me, what I really enjoyed is that I learned everything at the bottom level to like understand what these frameworks are designed to help me with, you know? So like with an ORM, a lot of the time you see people use ORMs when they don't know like SQL or like SQL that, you know, SQL at all, really. I'm not going to lie, like I'm not a SQL expert, but I know like enough SQL to kind of like get me through if I needed to use it and not use an ORM. But a lot of the times, like people don't know how to interact with their database unless they're using one of these technologies, which could present issue as well, which makes you just kind of think that like, all right, well, the bottom level is Drizzle or it's Marshmallow or whatever it is on Python. Like it's, yeah, I thought that was pretty powerful thing to say.
I've told the story before. I'll give you like the quick version. Basically, my first foyer into web development was with Python and Django. And
nice. Me too.
I shipped websites pretty quickly. They worked, you know, I just like manually tested them to make sure they worked. But to be honest, like I had very little understanding of what was going on and I was very insecure. Like I did not feel confident in the applications I was building because I didn't know what was going on. Like I knew that I could deploy it. I knew that it would like, quote unquote, work, right? But like, I didn't understand truly how the authentication was happening, right? I didn't understand how my data model was being kind of marshaled and transformed into the database and how it was coming back out again. I was really just like following tutorials and like getting things working. And like, that's fine, right? Like you can even get like an entry level job doing that. But I feel like I really leveled up as a developer when I started building a few things from scratch. At first, it was kind of just out of necessity because I wanted to get into Go and I saw some jobs in my area that were Go programming jobs. Also, Go was just interesting, but like building that first REST API, Carson Gross is like rolling over right now, the HTMX guy hearing me say REST API. That first JSON API that I made in Go was like really eye-opening to me because I finally understood, oh, this is how the authentication is working. Like, oh, this is how I take data from an HTTP handler and shove it into a database, like at a lower level. In your web development journey, is that the approach you took? Did you do it backwards? How do you think it's, you know, most effective?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's roughly the same. You know, for me, like authentication, simple. Pip install Django all auth, you know? Oh, databases, pip install this, you know? Oh, I need to do 2+2, pip install addition, you know what I mean? Like you just kind of do it like that. Pip install anything. Like
pip install anti-gravity, like, yeah.
Yeah, npm install website that orders pizza to your house, you know what I mean? Somehow there's a package for it and somehow the pizza gets to your front door, you know? Like it's funny how much like we rely on those packages when sometimes they are just better to maintain yourself. But yeah, it's the same kind of thing that you went through. Like at first, I guess when it came to the requirements, like for me specifically, you know, obviously I knew I don't want to roll out my own authentication because I don't think anyone should unless like you are like literally, you know, paid to be doing that. But for me, I think I was like, all right, I'll just use Python to be able to get authentication. And then like for my, one of my first projects, that XML thing I was talking about, I will use this package in order to validate, and do things. And when you use it, right, like it's like, honestly, it's great. It works awesome, but you kind of like what you're saying. Sometimes you run into these edge cases that you're like, okay, I don't know, like it's not working. And so because most of the time they're open source, it's like, you can't rely on the contributors to just like implement the feature that's going to make you money, right? Like they're not even getting paid for anything. So, but you can go into yourself, but if you don't know that bottom line feature, you're kind of like, well, like what is like, it's just magic. You know what I mean? Like I just call this function and somehow everything works. So I 100% agree. Like part of me was like, I need to learn more. I need to learn like how this works under and like how this framework is like making it easy for me to do all of this. And so a lot of times that's what I do. I'd contribute, I would find out, I'd learn how to do it and like how it works. And then that would give me the ability to go into an open source project that maybe I was using in my application and make a contribution because I know how it works. I think this feature would be great. Here it is implemented. Let me know if it, and it also like, it's almost like it's not double-edged sword. That's not the right term. I mean, sorry, it's just all benefits. You know, you learn more as a developer, you can contribute to open source, which, you know, you can get those sweet, sweet green squares on your profile, you know? And you can just be a better developer at the end of it. I think that was my first point, but yeah, you get the point.
One heuristic that I've used in the past, which is like, I like to go one layer deeper than where I do most of my work. So like if I do most of my work, you know, at the kind of back-end application layer, then I want to understand everything just like one layer deeper. So with the example of an ORM, if I use an ORM, I want to understand SQL, right?
Yeah.
If I like spent all my time just writing raw SQL, I'd want to go one layer deeper and understand like how the database is like kind of interpreting those instructions, right? Yeah. Like, I think it's like a really good, just, you know, it's not perfect in every case, but just if you're always one layer deeper than where you need to be, I feel like you'll be a really kind of good employee, right? You'll be really effective in whatever role you're in.
That's good for every... I was just saying that's good for every developer. Don't tell that to the assembly developers though, because they'll go crazy, you know? Like those are the people that do not go outside and they're gonna like forever, like, you know, like forever be like crazy, you know what I mean? They're like, oh yeah, 99% of development. Don't talk to those people though, because they go one layer deeper.
No, they got to go to the metal. They got to go to the metal. They got to go to circuits. Yeah. Which actually is like kind of true. I don't know if you know Low Level Learning, the YouTuber, but like he does, right? Like he's writing C in assembly and frequently he's talking about the hardware. So it is
funny, actually. I made a video where like, it was a short form video, and there's a game called Turing Complete where you build your own computer basically. So it is funny, you know, even though assembly, because you are right, like how does it interact with it? It just is funny to imagine like you just sitting there writing the machine code yourself, right? Like, all right, screw it. Assembly's not doing it for me. I gotta go, you know, you just always gotta go one layer down, and then you're just you're building
way too
computer.
Much abstraction happening in ARM assembly. Like I don't have nearly enough control.
You're going to the mines yourself and you're picking out the right COBOL that you want to use for your thing. You know what I mean? And taking it to your 3D printer, just chop it up the blocks. Yeah, that's funny.
This silicon has too much resistance.
We're going to need to purify it. Like this could not run my Rust app at 0.2 milliseconds faster. Not at all. You know, we can get some optimizations.
Oh, yeah. No, we optimize the nanosecond layer, nanosecond level here. But what you were saying just had me thinking of like another heuristic. So if like one heuristic that I like is this go one level deeper, another heuristic that's interesting to me is be the glue, in the sense that one complaint I had when I was using Django was that like Django was the glue for my application. Like there was the Django way to do everything. And when you used a Django, you used all the Django things. So like there was the Django handler, like HTTP handlers. There was the database layer that kind of interoperated, and that was all abstracted away from you. Whereas one thing I've really liked about, from a learning standpoint, like writing web servers in Go, is like there's still libraries that you use for stuff. Like I'll use a library for auth, right? Like I don't roll my own JWT library. I'm using a library. But my code is kind of from scratch in the sense that it just calls that code in the HTTP handler to do authentication. So I understand like at what point in my application the authentication happens rather than it being like magic middleware, if that makes sense. And I really do like from an educational perspective, kind of like you have to at least be the glue between all of these components, even if you didn't roll your own cryptography, right?
Yeah, no, it's funny you mentioned that because like in Python, like a lot of people talk about like, it's like, do you want it to be like Flask, like Flask versus Django? Because you're right. There's like Django is, I think they say on their website, batteries included. It's very heavily opinionated because they want you to follow the methodology. And that's where the magic lies on. Like, that's why you can build things so fast with it versus when you have something like Flask, right? It's like, we'll give you the basic HTTP kind of request library and like the server side handling. That's it. Everything else you got to get, like, you don't even have a ORM, you don't have authentication, that's all you have. And so for a lot of people, I think like for a lot of people who come from Django, they're like, okay, I want to be able to get the Django features, but I want like to be able to roll things out. I don't like the ORM, or I wish it could be better. I wish it could take advantage of this kind of one instead. Most of the time they do go to Flask, or I think it's Fast API now. That's kind of like the drop-in replacement now. But because I think people just kind of want to start using, I think as you just grow as a developer, you start realizing like, okay, when developers start working on one specific feature, they're able to make it a much better experience versus like if the Django developer team, who are incredible developers, by the way, but it's just like they're working on so much that like, and they also have to like, reach such a huge audience too, that they're like, we're just going to leave this as is. We're not going to give you the benefits, but you can grab the benefits. If you use the other package, that's when you end up moving on to the next framework, because like you can just piece everything together. Kind of like what you said, you glue it all together. It works really well.
Yeah. I look at dependencies as a cost. It's not like I don't use dependencies, but it is a cost in the equation. And so if I have dependencies that I'm not using, or like if I have a giant dependency and I'm only using, you know, 5% of its functionality, like that pains me inside. I'm worried about like the maintainability of that. It's something that.
And it's funny that because you're talking about Go, and that's funny because I'm actually learning Go right now, but what ends up happening is that you install so much stuff, but then obviously if you have issues with it, what if it's no longer maintained, right? But it's considered like the industry standard. Well, now you have to find a solution, and then things just break. And then also like the error handling too comes an issue, because like how do you handle the errors that maybe they, you know what I mean? You're 100% right.
That's interesting. I didn't know you were learning Go at the moment. That's great. Yeah. This is the year to learn Go.
This is the year of Go. This is the year of the Gopher. Is it Gopher? Is that a thing?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the Gopher. Yeah. Gopher for, or, I don't know. I'm trying to think of a cool tagline. You know what I mean? But like Gopher for President 2024. There we go. Gopher for President 2024.
That's gotta take the like Chinese zodiac and like delete one of them, put in a gopher, slap it on there. It's the year of the gopher.
It's the year of the gopher. This year is the year of the gopher. Yeah. Yeah. I'm looking forward to learning it. It's going to be really cool.
I want to just come back to our timeline a little bit. What possessed you to become like a freelancer and start your own agency? I don't feel like that's the default for most people that are like learning to code. I feel like most people just want to get like a W-2 job.
Yeah. Well, for me, I just didn't have, like after I finished school, I've been a freelancer my whole life, but you know, I've always been very, very ambitious. I like to kind of do my own thing. I like to create. So that's why I became a freelancer. And then also there weren't many jobs here where I live. Like where I live is a small conservative city here in Ontario. It's like, there's not a lot of things going on in tech at all. So for me, I just was like, all right, well, I'll just make my own job until I find one. And then I ended up starting with my friends, and then we just kind of kept building it and building it.
That's really impressive because like I've had a couple guests on that have talked about freelancing. Frankly, the vast majority of my guests have all been, you know, W-2 employees myself. And the sense I get is that like freelancing is actually playing on hard mode for the most part. That's not to say you shouldn't do it, but like, you know, you have to have skill set in addition to programming. Like you have to also be able to market and find clients and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely harder because like, you know, I think the risk is that like when you work in freelance, you just like any business, right? You can make as much money as you want. You can make your own hours. But in terms of this, like for programming specifically, you know, you might not have the opportunity to work on the awesome things. So like something that I think is so cool about people who decide to get jobs at big tech, or like maybe not even big tech, just like tech in general, they get to work on systems right away that is like actually making an impact on people. So like they learn about scaling, they learn about like types, they learn about documenting their code with like other people, like just right off the get-go. And that like automatically just makes them such a like a much better developer, because it allows them to do whatever they want. You know, like they can learn that. But like when you're a freelancer, you have to like learn that only under the condition if that's what they need. And most of the time they don't, right? Because most of the time they have a budget, and so you have to like budget things on your end. Also, a lot of the tech companies have a huge amount of financing. So like if you're like, yeah, you know what, like just create a Terraform configuration that deploys like a $5,000 infrastructure. It's like, whatever, right? It's a test run that they can do that. The tech companies, that comes out of your budget usually when you do it. So for there's pros and cons to it, right? But I think the cons are if like you're wanting to become a better developer, I wouldn't recommend freelancing, honestly. But if you want to like be your own boss, like you're, you know, programming is like more of a secondary thing to you, freelancing is a pretty all right option.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And you really, I feel like you've kind of, my understanding of your history is you freelanced for all these years and then you transitioned into content creation, right? Which is like, again, it's like you have to be able to code to make coding content, but then you also have to have like all these other skills on top of it, like making videos, editing, producing. Tell me a little bit about that, like that transition. Why did you start making coding videos?
Yeah. So it's funny because at the time, just in my life, I was feeling really burnt out after this like huge project that we worked on that like, you know, required a huge amount of my time and effort. I was just kind of like, I need to do something. Like, you know, it would literally be like, I wake up, go on the keyboard, type away, it's nighttime, go to bed. And I would do that sometimes for like weeks and weeks on end. You know, this fast iteration cycle. So I got burnt out, as you know, anyone would under that situation. And then I was like, all right, well, something I've always loved doing is making videos. Like I used to make videos back in the day when I was doing Roblox, like you said, like we talked about earlier. And so at first it started off on TikTok. So on TikTok.
No way. I had no idea you started on TikTok. I thought you started on YouTube.
No. So I started on TikTok. YouTube's the primary focus, right? Because YouTube is just way better than any other platform. But TikTok was where I started. And what's cool about TikTok is that the barrier of entry is is like nothing. If you go back onto my profile, all the way at the bottom, what you'll see is that there's videos of just me talking about this cool open source project that I found. And it's like, you know, it's just the camera to my face. And then I would just flip the camera to show what I'm talking about on screen.
You just like, here it is.
Yeah, literally, like, literally. Yeah. Yeah. You would just literally do that and that's it. And it's funny because that's all you needed at the time. And that's enough to like start momentum. And so that's when I started doing it very amateur style, not at all professional, edited, like didn't even go on my computer. It stayed on the phone. It stayed on the TikTok app, right? It didn't even go there. And then you just keep doing it and doing it, you know, listening to your community, listening to feedback, making it better. And because I just have such a passion for it, I just decided to keep getting it better. Like, how can I make this video just 1% better every single time? And that obviously compounds after so long, you know?
Yeah, I need video creation advice from you. I won't steal your time on the pod for that, but
I'm happy
trying to figure out how to make better videos.
I mean, like, where do you think, like for me, like my philosophy always has been like with my videos is that like, I'm not the best programmer. I'm not even like, I wouldn't even say I'm a great programmer. I'm like an all right programmer at most, you know, like I have fun with it. I understand like maybe when something needs to change, like people don't watch Coding with Lewis because they think I'm an epic programmer. There's been a couple times when I've been put like, you know, people have said like, oh, if you watch the Primogen, Low Level Learning or Coding with Lewis, you'll know that they're like gods at programming. And I'm like, yo, take me out of that list. You know, like I am not on that list. You know, like to me, I wouldn't even be able to pass a technical interview, I don't think, because I just don't practice for it. I just build things when I want to at this point. But The reasoning for this is that my philosophy has always been because I don't have this like epic programming skill set, I've always wanted to inspire developers. How can I make it so that if you're wanting to learn code or if you are a developer and want to, like maybe you're burnt out or something, or maybe you just are, you know, going through it, you can be like, oh man, like I want to go like open up my code editor right now and start coding something cool. That's always been the purpose of my videos. So I always like make sure that every video kind of like is encapsulated within this ideology.
I was actually just talking with some friends yesterday and we were chatting about this idea of like the schism or like the difference between like having technical ability and like the soft skills and the confidence that you need in your technical ability to like go ship projects and or like get a job or whatever. Mm-hmm. And what you're saying like makes a ton of sense to me. And I'm glad that somebody's out here like talking about that side of it, because mm-hmm. you don't have to be an amazing developer to get an entry-level job, but you do have to have confidence in your abilities and like be able to kind of market yourself as someone that can do stuff, or at the very least can learn how to do stuff that is useful to the company. It's not all about just, you know, being able to neovim better than everybody else.
No, for sure. And it's always funny because like obviously when I like, you know, I'm thinking content creation. So like, of course, it's a little bit out of context, I guess you could say, when we're talking about like getting a job. But like, you're 100% right. Like those soft skills where you can like talk to the users, understand what the users are going through. Like it's understandable why like sometimes those could be more valuable than a technical skill, obviously to an extent. Because, you know, if you think that you can cause the application to go 4 times faster, like on startup. But you have to like, you know, I have to go deep into the code. I have to refactor it all into this language or something. Then a lot of the times it's like not worth it because it's like, all right, well, that's just a big waste of time. People don't care really that, you know, but if you're like, I made this feature, it's kind of slow. It's sometimes buggy, but it is a huge time saver for a lot of our users. Well, I feel like a lot of the time, like, even just the users being heard almost is like half the battle, you know, and then that causes things to do really well. So yeah, the mix of the soft skills and the technical ability. And I guess you could say that that is a reflection of my channel where I feel like I have mixed those things well. I listen to my community, I engage in like what's popular. I make silly projects that just are so stupid sometimes to the point where it's just funny. And just like make entertaining content, I guess you could say. And that's like what the true value of my channel was as compared to like those who want to like teach JavaScript or Python or whatever it might be.
So let's talk about this video that you published. Like I said, that was pretty cool. The thumbnail's amazing, by the way. I love the like sad face in the camera.
Yeah.
It's titled, We Need to Talk About Developer Influencers. So give us like the premise. What's the problem as you see it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I mean, I guess the whole point of the video was a critique against developers and influencers and like how they mesh together into one. So of course, you know, if we look at influencers, right, just like from a general standpoint, right, the critiques are obvious. People have everything they have to say about them. But with developer influencers, what's interesting is that a lot of the time, people are taking what they are learning from their day-to-day job, and they're bringing it over into their YouTube channel where they can discuss it. That's kind of like where their experience comes from, right?
Yeah.
And so what ends up happening is that once your YouTube channel starts, you know, getting popular, once you start getting more views, you kind of have to choose between one or the other. A lot of the times you see a lot of developers, they still stay with both of them, but this has disastrous consequences because of burnout and mental health. And
your job's like, why do you spend 3 hours making videos every day?
And yeah. Like, I mean, there's like a lot of reasons why you burn out and then you end up hating both jobs. So you almost like lose both at the end. So for me specifically, what I had to do is I had my agency I was running with my friends. And then I also had this YouTube channel that was taking up a lot of time. So for my mental health, for my professional career, I think I'm just going to go to YouTube. It's what I've always wanted to do. I like consult with other brands too, to help with their social. So like there's a good amount of like ways to generate income. Like it just pays way better. I mean, most of the time you'll see a lot of influencers say they'll get paid more doing what they're doing on YouTube than they are on their thing. So that for me, that's what it is. But you also lose this ability to kind of bring this experience into your job, especially if you're like a developer who is trying to get people into the industry, or if you're trying to teach a specific thing, because what ends up happening is that you kind of almost at sometimes lose touch. Like how can I feel credible if you don't work in the tech industry? Are you, right. You know, so this is kind of like what the dilemma is, I guess you could say, in the developer influencer area, because like, how can you really give your honest opinion when like it's your job to make videos like this, you know, like that's what you're being paid for. And that's kind of like why I'd like to touch on. It was more so I wouldn't say it's at all like I did frame the title and thumbnail to make it seem like, you know, canceled, right? But realistically, it's like, it's just a critique of how like the specific niche of like developers and influencers and how like the two is in a weird area once you hit a certain level. How do you pivot your content? How do you make sure that this transparency doesn't affect the way people see you?
It's such a good topic to talk about. So I've thought about it a lot, but not necessarily from the influence angle, more from the educational angle. So you could barely call me an influencer, first of all. Like my YouTube channel is small. My Twitter presence is small. This podcast is growing, but still fairly small. But I've been in the educational space, right? Obviously, I run boot.dev. We teach Python and Go and backend programming. And when I started Boot Dev, it was a side project on the side of my full-time job as an engineering manager, right? And exactly like you said, like the reason I felt like I had a lot to share in Go, back in programming, Python, because like that's what I was doing for my career. I went full-time on Boot Dev a year and a half ago. And I feel like one amazing advantage that I've had is that Boot Dev is it's a custom-built application. Mm-hmm. That like we're rolling custom features for, and like the site itself is super interactive. So I actually do spend a good amount of my time still like coding on the platform. And that's been like how I've tried to mitigate the problem, even though I do spend, you know, a lot more time in the day these days recording podcast episodes and, you know, writing blog posts and stuff. I feel like I've at least been able to, you know, keep some percentage of my just day to day coding, which has been nice.
I was just gonna say, like, and I think that is fantastic, right? Like I think it's really good because like a story like yours like resonates with a lot of people, because I think like arguably speaking, that's where most people want to be. They want to say like, yeah, like if I work at a job and I built my own app that takes off, like that's ideal. If anything, that's like a programming 101 like textbook decision. Like that's
the dream, network, right?
Yeah. Like look at the movie The Social Network. Like, I mean, obviously we're talking about completely different like scales here, right? But I mean, I think a lot of people become programmers for this idea of freedom, for getting out of the situation they're in. Maybe they're stuck in an area where they don't want to be. So that's what, like, so like almost like stories like yours is a dream. And obviously congrats to that, because it's epic to see. But I think for me, like where I wanted to pivot, because like a lot of my videos was talking about how to get into the industry or like how to do this. And like, although I do find that the videos that I did do were well-researched, they're high quality, I just felt like, you know, I'm at a point now where I don't know if like this like career advice or like how to become a programmer, like in this like talking head style is like the right type of videos I can make anymore, because I don't feel 100% honest making them. And so, and that's not just to any other developers. Like I know a lot of people have their own like name in their head when they say like, it wasn't to start drama, it wasn't to do anything, because I have a lot of respect for a lot of other people. For me, what I did to transition over to my channel was like months and months prior to this even happening. But like, I, you know, I wanted to make videos where I help people, like I kind of tell a story. Like that's why I think I do best in my stories, like, all right, how can I tell the story of how Discord scaled to trillions of
I was hoping right? you'd reference that. That's my favorite video of yours. It's an amazing video. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, so that video right there is like, you know, I take the article, which for many people would be a little bit too technical, which is a fantastic article. But, you know, it's just a way to dumb it down and make it a little bit easier for people to understand. Or I like those videos, or I like the video I did about the Reddit API scandal and how like that story happened about how like Reddit took advantage of that. And then also like building a $10,000 trading bot and giving it stocks, because like, again, I don't have to be like, my background there doesn't incentivize you to watch the video. It's just what happens on the video. So to me, that's just the honest way of doing it. And so I'm very happy I decided to make that transition into doing stuff like that. But yeah, it's a hard game, you know. I don't blame people for having to tailor themselves towards the algorithm, because that's equally as dangerous.
The algorithm, so to speak, like just the way YouTube, TikTok, these platforms work, like this is all like new frontier. The way everyone's succeeding on these platforms, it's always different. And as you pointed out, sometimes the incentives are aligned really well with like making good, valuable content. Sometimes they get out of whack. And that's always something to watch out for, something I think about a lot. I haven't come across like a lot of really good, like hard and fast rules or heuristics for how that works. Also because it seems like the kind of content that works on these different social platforms like changes even just, you know, month to month.
Yeah.
But
yeah, at the moment, here's my kind of take right now on the programming, or like, I mean, really meta across all platforms here. So I find like, if those are not familiar with my channel, like I post like I do a lot of the time editing and like doing crazy intense editing on my videos. So that's kind of like where I kind of lie in the niche. I find that YouTube specifically, they very much value the high quality editing. They very much value this like production. People are used to production on YouTube, like, you know, high quality. So they want to see that reflected in the short form content, at least. On TikTok, it's more intimate. People want to kind of almost like see your lens of the world through the camera. And so I find that high quality stuff doesn't do as well on there. It's still capable of doing well, but I think you're going to find much more success when you do the more like intimate style video that's over a minute long. So that's also
oh wow too. Yeah,
so yeah, so it has to, so if it's over a minute long and like sometimes like even like 3 to 4 minutes long, it does really well there. Instagram is always a hit or miss, you know, you just kind of do whatever, it'll land.
We don't know about Instagram.
No one knows. And does anyone care? I don't know. You know, so yeah, no, like that's why I think with those platforms is like each one of them has its own kind of unique little twist.
Yeah, no, that's interesting to hear. I am an absolute noob at video content. I'm just starting to take it seriously and figure it out. This podcast has been like really my project to try to do some stuff. Like you mentioned, we'll cut some shorts out of this podcast and post them. Post them in different places. But I'm so glad, like, you answered the question before I asked it. I was just gonna say, like, what's next for, like, what is the future of the Coding with Lewis channel? It sounds like more of those kinds of videos that were already my favorite video, so teardowns of Discord, you know, and then like them changing their storage engine, things like that. Sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, well, we so the plan with the channel is like, you know, we have like, you know, it's a bit in two directions almost, but like, yeah, making more of those story time type of videos where we discuss maybe like a crazy event that happening, but still related to code, because that's like where the knowledge, where my knowledge kind of lies in. So being able to do something like that, or building crazy projects. So again, like kind of doing the $10,000 trading bot thing again, but like,
yeah,
what can we build that is like so cool? Right now we're actually building a social media app that's like a Twitter clone, but it's like, it's only run by bots. So like the everything, like all the pictures that's being uploaded, all the text, like it's all being generated, like they're talking. And so it's like, and then people can like view it in real time. So it's kind of like a, just like an interesting,
you just journey. Watch bots interact on Twitter.
Yeah. But these bots are obviously like people that you, like Spider-Man or something, or like Peppa Pig, or one of these like characters that like takes on the role of that and is like talking on the social media app that can generate.
Is that like images. LLM driven? Like,
yeah. Oh, completely LLM driven. Yeah. So it's like agents, I guess you could say. So yeah, like things like that. And then just like working on these like cool projects, and then also live streaming these projects too, to build like, to get like a little bit more of a deeper dive into like me building these projects talk. So, and then just increasing the production quality as well. Like we are doing a lot of 3D work right now too, to like increase the quality some more. We're doing some more like crazy edits, like, you know, with sound design and stuff. Like it takes a lot to make a video like this, but I love doing it, you know? So it's, I'm really excited to see what comes out this year.
It's funny you mentioned like the edits, the high production quality. Like I was talking with my editor producer and I was like, this is like a good example of good production quality, pointing him to your YouTube videos. That's kind of how I've seen your channel as well. Like it's clear. Mm-hmm. Do you do all your own editing and producing?
Yeah. So I have a team that helps me now. So right now it's me that edits. I also have Will, who I've worked with for the last, like, so that video about Discord, he edited a lot of that too. Actually, I think he probably edited most of it, but he edits, helps me edit as well. We both are like a team. Like we still, like I'm still involved in the editing process, but like, yeah, between the two, like we do most of it. And then we have some other editors that kind of like help chop things up here along the way too. But yeah, it's like it's starting to become a production team. But yeah, for a lot of the videos that you've seen, like I would have had my hand in editing too, but yeah, Will and I for the most part.
That's really cool. Great. Well, thanks so much for coming on, man. Where can people find your channels? Do you want to like plug just a couple of places people could find you?
Yeah. First of all, boot.dev for the best backend courses you can find.
Well, duh. This make is sure the year of learning Go.
Yeah. Make sure you use /coding with Lewis today. No, joking.
Now I have to go add a code.
Yeah. But boot.dev, awesome stuff there. I got to give, you know, props to you for hosting this. So, but for just on YouTube, primarily, Coding with Lewis. If you search me up, you can probably find some of the things like my Reddit bot that I built that makes the videos, or the YouTube AI chat. There's a lot of different projects, but go ahead on my Coding with Lewis channel. You can also find me on Twitter, where I shitpost for the most part, post nothing productive, but maybe it'll make you giggle or chuckle, you know? So
yeah,
that's where I'm at.
Awesome. Thanks again for coming on, man. Everyone that's listening to this, you know, we're primarily backend developers. That Discord video, I actually think you did two of them, or just the one?
I did one video where it was billions of messages. Then they released their new article about like 2 weeks later. And I was like, all right, well, I got to redo this video now.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, go check out that video. It's a fantastic dive into basically these database issues that Discord was having. So can't recommend that enough. Thanks again for coming on, man.
Oh, thanks for having me, Lane.